The Department of Children and Family Services has had 11 directors in the last 16 years, and a new report from its inspector general says more children are dying even after DCFS had already checked up on them. We'll also get a tour of the Illinois Holocaust Museum's newest exhibit. It focuses on the dangerous journeys that slaves made after they already got to America. Plus, the radical past of the Sears catalog and how it helped disrupt segregation in the Jim Crow era.
The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media, airing on WILL in Urbana, WUIS in Springfield, WGLT in Normal, WNIJ in DeKalb, and WCBU in Peoria.
That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Coming up later this hour, we're revisiting one of our favorite conversations about Sears and its radical past you might not know about. We'll also get a tour of the Illinois Holocaust Museum's newest exhibit, which explores the lives of tens of thousands of Americans who were affected by the domestic slave trade here in the U.S. But first, the Department of Children and Family Services, or DCFS, is responsible for protecting our most vulnerable residents. Since 2013, the number of Illinois children who have died while being in contact with DCFS in some way has stayed at about 100 a year. That number is troubling enough, but there's another death rate that's increasing, and that's the kids who died after DCFS had already investigated a case. In other words, the department looked into possible abuse or neglect, closed the case, and a child later died. We reached out to the Department of Children and Family Services. They declined our invitation but sent us a statement. We'll get to that in a minute. We learned about the story through Hannah Mizell, who reported on this for the Daily Line, and she's with us now from Springfield. Hi, Hannah. Welcome back to the 21st.
Hi, Nyla.
Also on the line with us is Andrea Durbin, CEO of the Illinois Collaboration on Youth. They represent 85 providers across the state that focus on Illinois' children and youth, particularly vulnerable ones. Andrea, welcome back to the show. Good morning.
Good morning.
Hannah, can I start with you and just this report that comes out every year from the Inspector General of DCFS? What stood out to you the most? Why did you first want to report on this?
Right. This is an annual report, nothing out of the ordinary. Other news outlets had actually picked up on it first. And when the ACLU of Illinois put out a statement the other day, I thought I would read through it. And what stood out to me, you know, of course, like you said, it's a tragedy if even one child dies. The number has actually decreased, at least in the last year. It was 108 in fiscal year 2017, 98 last fiscal year. However, the number of children who have died, even after the cases have been opened, investigated, and then determined what's called unfounded, which means, you know, the claims were not founded, the investigation couldn't go forward because not enough evidence was found, that seemed to be increasing. So that was alarming to me because that means that DCFS is aware of issues and yet was not able to step in to, you know, prevent a child from dying.
And so when we're talking about claims, I imagine you're talking about claims of abuse or neglect. And I wonder if you can explain a little bit more about what is supposed to happen when DCFS conducts an investigation into possible child abuse.
Right. So from what I understand, I am no expert on this, but from what I understand, reports of abuse and neglect can come in several ways. A big way is through a hotline that DCFS operates. And they get many, many thousands of calls a year. They investigate, I believe it's about around 80,000 of the 200-something thousand calls that they get. Now, that doesn't mean that DCFS is just, you know, pushing those other calls out of the way and saying, you know, we're not going to investigate. They're going through their process. They're going through their steps. They're seeing if there is enough to go forward through every step. And then an investigator who is either a direct employee of DCFS or contracted through a private agency, they are the ones who are going into the home and investigating these claims. And, you know, something the inspector general told me when we talked the other day is that abuse is easy to see. You know, you can see a bruise, you can see a black eye. Neglect is a bit harder to quantify and substantiate because, I mean, that can take many forms. It can take, you know, emotional neglect. And something that Andrea Durbin and I were speaking yesterday, and I thought a really good thing that she brought up was sometimes, you know, what looks like neglect is also just what looks like poverty. And, you know, we judge each other's poverty in different ways depending on your social class and your race. And, you know, these things are really hard to investigate.
Andrew, I wonder if you could explain a little bit more about that to us as someone who works with this on a regular basis. What else makes it sounds like there's a lot about this that makes these situations really difficult for DCFS to handle effectively?
Well, thank you. And I want to be clear that the private sector is not involved in the investigations side of things. So this is the piece of, you know, once the hotline call is made and the screening process determines that an investigation is warranted and an investigation is conducted, that's all done by the public sector, as it should be, because that's kind of a police power, right?
Thanks for making that clarification, right.
And, yeah. So I just want to be clear that when I'm speaking about it, it's not from the work that we are doing. Our providers interact with the system to the extent that they make hotline calls, which they do regularly. So in that role, we are all what we call mandated reporters, as are many, many other professionals, such as law enforcement and teachers and medical professionals and I believe clergy. And there's a whole slew of folks out there who are considered to be mandated reporters. Anyway, so when kids are flagged in the system, the biggest reason the across the country that kids come into child welfare is because of neglect. And the second biggest reason is related to drug abuse and addictions. And it's true. It's like neglect can be sometimes very clear, and sometimes it can be, you know, very much a judgment call. I mean, sometimes it could be what we call medical neglect, where people either don't understand or don't have the ability or the facilities to correctly care for their child's medical needs. You know, it could be, you know, like the people don't understand the kinds of medications that they need to take or the routine that they have to be on. That would be something you might consider to be medical neglect. Or they don't have the way to care for the equipment that a child needs to live, that sort of thing. Neglect could be, you know, we talk about messy houses, and I don't mean like untidy, but we're talking about unsanitary, you know. And so what constitutes an unsanitary house? You know, we all have our own definitions of that. Certainly the folks who go out and are trained to look at that, you know, have a more wide range of experience in assessing what is an unsanitary living condition than just, you know, what a casual person might think, you know, because we all have our own standards of living.
Yeah, that makes sense.
But, so I think that, you know, I want to stress that these people are professionals and they are trained and they do, but they, at the end of the day, they are making judgment calls sometimes. And it's not ever going to be a perfect science. It's always going to be, you know, thinking about sort of a marriage of art and science, if you will, of like, these are things we know are warning factors. This is what my gut is telling me, you know, and in that, you know, sometimes people, we all bring our own biases and backgrounds, and the more aware we are of those implicit biases, the better we are, hopefully, at making judgments that aren't driven just by those, but we're all human.
Hannah, I wanted to ask, as Andrea's describing all of this, I want to get to the whole idea of caseload and staffing issues, but I first just want to ask you about the fact that 37 children died after a caseworker had investigated either a parent, a guardian, a home, or another situation, and then classified that complaint as unfounded. Can you tell us a little bit about some of these deaths? Which ones stood out to you?
Sure. There was one in particular that really stood out. In 2017, there were several high-profile deaths. I'm sure some listeners remember the case of Samaj Cosby, a 17-month-old who was found dead underneath a couch, even after DCFS had interacted with that family. Another case is 4-year-old Manny Aguilar. He died in July of 2017 after being starved to death by his mother and her boyfriend. After he died, the mother and the boyfriend's brother allegedly put his body in a blanket and put him in the basement of an abandoned home in Englewood where they lived and lit it on fire. According to prosecutors, the boy was so malnourished. They thought they were dealing with a 9-month-old baby and not a 4-year-old. Apparently, the boy was mostly kept in a back room of the home, denied food, often beaten with a shoe. The mother allegedly wouldn't let her older kids help him, even when he would yell through the door to let him out. And apparently, the room was full of his own urine and feces. News reports at the time had reported that DCFS had been in contact with his family before. In 2012, this mother's 4 kids were taken away from the mother after she'd let the 3 oldest in a car overnight while temperatures hovered around freezing. But in the report, we found out that after she got her children back in 2015, actually during the process where she was being allowed unsupervised overnight visits, there was a case opened about alleged abuse after there were bruises seen on some of the children. And then after she fully got her children back, the older children were allegedly texting their former foster families that they were being abused again. And so DCFS opened a subsequent investigation. And so that's the one that was closed 6 months before Manny Aguilar was found dead.
These stories are just heartbreaking. Hannah Meisel is telling us about them. She's been reporting on this with the Daily Line. Andrea Durbin is also with us. I should note to our audience, we did reach out to DCFS about this report. They sent us a statement that said, "The deaths of children and families where DCFS has involvement are profound tragedies that deeply impact too many communities. We appreciate the OIG's report and are troubled by the findings. And they went on to say they've taken significant steps to reduce caseloads and collaborate with other departments and private agencies. Andrea, I wanted to ask you just about that statement. Do you feel like when we're talking about caseloads, there's a lot here in terms of what caseworkers are dealing with? Do you feel like DCFS is sufficiently staffed right now to handle all of this?
Well, there's the, I think we should distinguish. So there's the DCFS employees who handle all the investigations, as I said, and then they also have some caseworkers as well. And then once the child protective side of things is concluded, the private sector providers serve about 80% of the kids in care, between 80 and 85. It obviously varies every day. But that the private sector, so the workforces are not exactly the same is what I'm struggling to tell you. So on the public sector side, you know, I don't have any data about that. I know that the governor's budget has requested more investigators. And, obviously, I think that seems like a good idea. We do want to have these investigators fully staffed, the child protective workers fully staffed, and be able to make sure that kids are, that investigations are completed in a timely manner and that kids are assessed properly and that they're in safe living conditions. That's the number one priority of the department. On the public sector side, you know, I'll say that our workforce is struggling. We are seeing turnover rates between, depending on the job title, between like 35 and up to 50% a year. It's been a real challenge. And when you think about what those turnover rates mean, think about it from the point of view of a child or a family. For a kid, a young person, it's not really satisfying to hear, oh, my caseworker left because they got a promotion or they got a better job somewhere else. They just think of that as another way that another adult has let them down.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
Right. From a family's point of view, let's say you're waiting to adopt or something like that, and your caseworkers you know, got a better job somewhere else. Now you're back sort of almost back.
Right, and everyone starts over.
Get to know the caseworker all over again.
That makes a lot of sense. Hannah, can I ask you about with the IG, what has the IG's office seen anecdotally about caseloads and workers?
Well, I tried to ask DCFS a couple times this week. Now, I didn't FOIA. I think that'd be my next step. But about their caseworkers over time, that employment, I mean, in state government in general, we've seen a hollowing out of these rank and file employees who do, you know, the ground level work that's so important. But anecdotally, I know that this week, I believe this week, there's an undated letter, just says February 2019, from the Joliet field office that was sent anonymously to Governor Pritzker and a couple other people on his administration, the inspector general herself, and some news outlets in Chicago. And it's a letter that says, you know, we're writing on behalf of the Joliet Child Protection Investigators. They say we should have a staff. I'm reading directly from the letter. It says we should have a staff of about 30 CPIs, and we have less than half of the staff.
Wow. We're so continuing. I'm going to stop you there, Hannah, because we're almost out of time. I just want to ask you very quickly. Right now, I know DCFS has had 9 different directors in the last decade. Do we know anything about who Governor Pritzker will pick as its next director?
We don't know yet. He's doing a national search right now. But yeah, I mean, that statistic is sobering. But I also want to point out that some of those people were always meant to be just interim.
Okay. I want to thank Hannah Meisel for being with us with The Daily Line. We'll tweet out Hannah's story so you can read more about this. Andrea Durbin for also being with us, CEO of the Illinois Collaboration on Youth. Both of you, thank you.
Thanks. You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for tuning into The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. When you hear slave trade, often what may come to mind is the cruel and dangerous journey when Africans were brought by boat to this country. But you may not think about the journey slaves made once in America, no less cruel and dangerous, and sometimes merely by foot throughout states. This domestic slave trade is explored in a new exhibition at the Illinois Holocaust Museum and Education Center. It's called Purchase Lives, and I had a chance to visit recently and was taken on a tour by the museum's head, Ariel Weininger. So this, we are standing at the beginning of this exhibition, and so this covers a time period from 1808 to 1865. Can you tell us the significance of those dates?
Sure. The international slave trade became illegal. The ships coming over from Africa became illegal in the early part of 1807 and then was enacted in January of 1808. So what ends up happening, because slavery is not prohibited within the United States until 1865, is that there's recirculation of enslaved people in the United States because of labor needed in the agricultural Upper South and then really down into the Deep South.
And this exhibit documents one particular aspect of how people were passed through, forced to New Orleans, and then sold through New Orleans?
Yes. So New Orleans becomes the center of the domestic slave trade, and that's what's covered in the exhibition.
So how were people actually moved?
So people were, enslaved people in great numbers were in the Upper South because of the tobacco industry. And with the decline of the tobacco industry and those areas moving to wheat production, and because of the Louisiana Purchase, which really opened up a lot of the United States, what we now consider the United States, and the taking of Native American lands, whole areas were now opened up for the production of cotton. Because of the advent of the cotton gin, production of cotton had become much easier and you could make things much faster. So the need for it was much higher, cotton. In Louisiana in particular, the the agricultural product that was mostly grown was sugar. So
another very labor-intensive.
Yes. Both of these are very labor-intensive, and so they required a lot of laborers. So there was demand to move enslaved people south. So the way in which they were brought south was often on foot. They were driven by men on horseback with whips. There also at this point in time is the growth of the railroad industry and of steamships. And so both of those are utilized to a great extent by the slave trade.
So people walked?
People walked. And so there's actually an object in the exhibition that you can see. It's a manifest of 63 individuals who are shipped along the steamer Hibernia from Louisville to New Orleans. But what's interesting about the document, and you can see it when you look at it, is those individuals are from Virginia. So they were walked, forcibly walked from Virginia to Louisville and then put on the ship and sailed down to New Orleans.
Do we have a sense of how many people?
There's actually an interactive kiosk in the museum where you can see from the different towns in the Upper South to the Deep South that about 72,000 people came to New Orleans in that fashion. But there was also localized trading that was happening down in New Orleans that is not included in those lists. So that is that about 1 million people. And then there was another 2 million people, or another million people if you looked at it in total. So it's about 2 million people that are circulated within this time period in the domestic slave trade.
So when we think about this and the domestic slave trade, there were companies, there were people, this was a business. People were making money off of this.
Yeah, and really in every aspect of it. So there is the shipping that's involved, the sale of human cargo itself, the lawyers that were involved in the sales of people, the notaries that had to notarize the sales. And further in the exhibit, it really gets into the practical aspects of the sale of clothing that was bought by the plantation owner to clothe the enslaved people that he purchased, to feed the enslaved people that were on his plantation. Also, the sale of people, this was often mortgaged. So banks were involved in all of this. It really is the fabric of the entire economy of not only the South, but of the United States.
And so we're standing in front of a portrait here of a gentleman named Isaac Franklin, who is one of these names that you start to see on all of these documents.
Mm-hmm. Isaac Franklin was part of a company that became the most profitable slave trading company in the United States. He and his company set up regular shipments, bi-monthly shipments of ships that would go from the Upper South to the Lower South, to the Deep South. And because of that, they needed to have a certain amount of slaves on those shipments. They had to have a certain amount of human beings on those ships. So we think about the story of 12 Years a Slave, of Solomon Northup. He was one of these people that in order to get a ship full of human cargo.
So he was actually free and he was kidnapped.
Yes, he was a free man from New York City who was in Washington, D.C. He was kidnapped and ended up being sold into the South. And he was there for 12 years. And then afterwards, he wrote his book, 12 Years a Slave.
And so that's because these companies actually had quotas. They needed people to sell.
Yep.
So this is where we actually start seeing people being stolen, even if they're not in slavery,
yes,
just to fill these quotas,
yes,
of the slave trade.
Yes, exactly.
Can you tell us a little bit about this?
Yeah, so we are looking at a wall that has a number of advertisements of human beings for sale. There are announcements of auctions. There are how many people would be at that auction.
So I have to say, standing here, it's kind of horrifying to read the language of this. Like, there are headlines that say, like, slaves, 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 with an exclamation point.
The one that you pointed out is actually one that we should take a look at, because the name underneath, Slaves, 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 by Benjamin Kendig and Company is a name that we'll see later in the exhibition. The ad goes on to say, will be sold at auction at the St. Louis Exchange on Wednesday, the 1st of February at 12 o'clock. Henry, aged about 19 years, field hand fully guaranteed. Millie, aged about 19 years also, she's a field hand and fully guaranteed. And her child, aged about 2 years. What's important about how Millie is being marketed with her two-year-old child is one could get a larger price for a woman who showed that she was fertile, because that would mean not only would you be buying her and her daughter, but that she likely
you would be
have
buying her future offspring as
correct.
Well.
Correct.
Hmm. I wonder, obviously, you're the chief curator at the Holocaust Museum, and you often do exhibitions that look at people who have been enslaved in various ways. And I wonder what it's like to do something like this that's really about American history, as opposed to something that we often, that I think when we think about the Holocaust Museum, mm-hmm. we tend to think about things that happened outside the U.S.
Mm-hmm. As you said, the mission of the Holocaust Museum is very much based in teaching the history and lessons of the Holocaust, but it is also essential to our mission to look at other genocides, atrocities, crimes against humanity. So in terms of subject matter, slavery is exactly that. I think that there are many parallels. We never want to compare these atrocities, but there are parallels. And I think if when a society determines that there is a group of people that are other, that they can then dehumanize these individuals, even though we know that they are human beings. And with that, they can be brutalized. Their families can be separated, their children taken away from them, they can be murdered. And those are the parallels that unfortunately exist between the Holocaust, slavery, and many other crimes against humanity.
We're here at the Holocaust Museum talking about this exhibition, which you all have actually brought here from New Orleans.
Yes.
You have a huge map that shows that this trade happened across the city, not just in specific slave markets.
Yes. In New Orleans, as it was this center of the slave market in the South, It's interesting to note, and we see it throughout the exhibit, that it did not only happen in specific sort of grand places or markets, but it happened in small, out of small slave pens, in private sales, in private homes. But then there are some very significant sites of sale, and most notably, which is explained in the exhibition, is the St. Louis Hotel.
And so there's actually a picture of how of the ballroom of the hotel, and it's this beautiful ballroom, and this is where slave trade happened?
Yeah, the rotunda of the St. Louis Hotel was actually in the lobby. So this was something that was very easily accessible to those that were coming by. They could sort of pop in and see this. There were four auction blocks with four auctioneers. You see in the engraving that the people who are at the auction are really wearing their best clothing. This was an event to go to.
So we talked about in the beginning how much of this is based on cotton and the cotton gin. Mm-hmm. And you have an artifact in the exhibition that's actually a piece of cotton fabric?
There are two pieces in the exhibition. One of them is a head wrap, a madras head wrap, that would be worn by a woman who would be in slavery. And then we also have a jacket on display. The jacket is from Brooks Brothers, a company that still is around today. The cotton, it really shows the full circle of the economy of slavery. The cotton, which in this case for the jacket is the interior lining, was grown in the South and harvested by slaves. The material was then sent north to most likely Massachusetts to be processed into the cloth, sent to businesses like Brooks Brothers, who then made fairly cheap but clean and good-looking clothing that would be sold then back south to a slave owner for, in this case, a jacket that would be worn by a servant inside of the home.
One of the most significant pieces in this exhibition is we're standing in front of this massive book that is the admission book of the Touro Infirmary?
Yes. What's really incredible about this object is how detailed it is. So along the pages of the logbook, it says who the patient was, their place of birth, their occupation, how long they had been in New Orleans when they got admitted to the hospital, who paid the bill for them while they were in the hospital. And you see, especially when you look down the list of occupation, we have to remember that at this time, many people wouldn't go to a hospital. They would have care by their family in their home. So this really was something that was for people
that... It's kind of a last resort.
Yeah, and for people who weren't from New Orleans. Because it was such a port city, you'll see that some of the places that people come from, Jamaica, Maine, Canada, Ireland, these are people who were shipmates that were on the ships that were coming into port. And then, of course, you see for the most of the page that it's open to, the majority of the people that are here are listed as slave. The reason being is that the movement from the Upper South to the Deep South was awful. It was oftentimes called the Second Middle Passage. So whether they were walking, whether they were on these ships or trains, held in very tight quarters, people were ill, people were not fed, there was diarrhea, there were venereal diseases. And so what the slave traders would do is they would bring them into the hospital, pay these very minimal fees to have the enslaved people attended to, so when they went to auction, they could get a higher price for them.
And so that brings us to the final wall of the exhibit, where we see actually a lot of Illinois ties here. And I wonder if you could, these are letters, and they're letters to the Southwestern Christian Advocate. Can you tell us about this newspaper?
Sure. The Southwestern Christian Advocate was a Methodist paper in New Orleans, and there's also advertisements that come from the Black Republican, also from New Orleans. These are what we call lost friends ads. They were free to place, and they were for people to find their loved ones. On the large wall in front of us, what we've done is that in the exhibition, there is a database of about 2,400 of these ads.
So if you come here, you can actually look up the
ads. Yeah, you can look them up. You can look them up by state, by city. And what we chose to do was to pull out and enlarge so you could read them quite easily, the ones that related to Illinois and or Chicago. There are 22 of the ads here, and I think it's important for people to understand that when we think about slavery and we think about the slave trade and the effects of slavery, this is not something that is just a story of the South or the Deep South. It affects the entire country, as we saw earlier in the economics of it. And in the after effects, you see people that have now moved here or they think that a family member may be in Illinois, and so they're asking if we know where they are. So the way in which...
Right, so we see towns, we see Peoria, we see Cairo, of course we see a lot of Chicago, people saying whether they're living there or they heard that a family member went to Illinois and they're trying to find them. Here's another one in Springfield.
Yeah. And the way in which these would be used, so not only would they be printed in these papers that circulated throughout different regions, but they also, the editor of the Southwestern Christian Advocate, he asked that people read these in church on Sundays so as to broadcast to a wider public the names of those that were being sought and if there were ways to connect people. The interesting part about these ads is the ones that we have on display primarily are from 1877 and beyond, but they actually begin even as early as 1865, and they go all the way until 1912. So people are still looking for their family members for, 50 years.
Ariane, why did you want to bring this exhibit to Illinois?
I think that it is, unfortunately, the topic of slavery, which this show only, deals with one aspect, is something that our country has not dealt with. The ramifications of it can still be felt, Chicago being this site of one of the major centers of the Great Migration. There are impacts, again, for our city throughout the country, and I think it's more than time for our country to really deal with the issues of slavery, the time period itself, and the ramifications of it that are ongoing until today.
Thank you. Thank you for taking the time to take us through this exhibit.
Thank you so much, Nyla, for being here.
That's Arielle Weininger from the Illinois Holocaust Museum and Education Center. The new exhibition, Purchase Lives, is open now. We'll tweet out information about it and have it up at our website at 21stshow.org. You're listening to The 21st. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Last fall, Sears announced it was filing for bankruptcy and closing 142 of its stores that were losing money. Four of those stores are here in Illinois. This, of course, had a lot of people talking about the loss of jobs, the impact on nearby real estate, and what this means for the future of big retail. At that time, there was also a Twitter thread started by Lewis Hyman, a professor at Cornell University, that sparked a lot of interest and got us thinking about another side of the iconic Illinois retailer. Not its softer side, but its radical one. Hyman tweeted, "In my history of consumption class, I teach about Sears. But what most people don't know is just how radical the catalog was in the era of Jim Crow. What can we learn from the way Sears helped disrupt segregation?" I spoke with Lewis from his office in New York late last year. He's an economic historian and the director of the Institute for Workplace Studies at the School of Industrial and Labor Relations at Cornell University. I started by asking him what retail was like in the late 1800s.
Well, most Americans were living in rural America, and in those rural areas, especially in the South, people shopped at one store. It was the general store. And it was basically a monopoly relationship. It was the one place where you could go and get credit because you had to wait until the harvest to get all your accounts settled. And if you were a sharecropper, especially if you were a black sharecropper, it was a very fraught relationship.
And so how does it fraught in a lot of ways? I wonder if you can help us understand not just economically, but how Jim Crow laws, especially when we're talking about in the South, affected African Americans' ability to actually even buy things.
Absolutely. So, of course, there is the monopoly relationship and its economic problems. But just like today, the way in which monopoly carries over into politics is really the concerning part. And so in the era of Jim Crow, which began around 1890 in Mississippi, it was a time when African Americans were forced to defer in all things to white people in public spaces like restaurants and trains and stores. And behind that deference was not simply discrimination or like waiting a little longer. It was a threat of violence. If you stepped out of line, you could be killed. Your family could be killed. Your property could be taken away. And so the catalog offered a way for African-American shoppers to avoid those very dangerous situations.
Dangerous situations, and certainly, I mean, I think we hear stories in the past, and we think about how many people, when we think about how many people were lynched, for example, and a lot of those are interactions that maybe happened at a store. I mean, this really was life-threatening in some ways just to do things like go into a store. Lewis, so Sears comes along as a catalog company. I wonder if you can help us with that. So how is this a game changer? Just the fact that, first of all, they're offering people things to buy by catalog.
Yeah, just imagine if every time you went to the store, you were afraid of what could happen to you or your family. And suddenly there's this catalog and you can look in it and you can see the streets of Chicago. You can see all the things that are available for sale there. And in your local store, the white shopkeeper wouldn't let you buy the same shirts as white people or buy the same flour as white people. And in this catalog, you can buy whatever you want, the same things as white people have, the higher quality things. And Sears offered credit, just like your local store did. So people were able to buy things at a distance. And it was a pretty amazing intervention in a time when everything was so local and so bound up in these kinds of power relationships that were about race, to have something that was about market relationships and really helped people, especially black people, get out of those situations.
So how did they, yeah, I mean, I think people who are in Chicago know the, if you've been to Chicago, you know the old post office and how big it was, and that, and people who know Chicago history know that was because of the catalog operations. That's the building that's, it's a huge building that's, I think, still abandoned right now. But how was this catalog, and if we're thinking about the late 1800s, how were people getting this in the South? Was this catalog being mailed to everybody, or how did that happen?
You could request it. It could be smuggled in. It could be passed from person to person. You know, the other great Chicago institution of that time was the African American newspaper,
the Defender.
Chicago
mm-hmm.
Defender, yeah. And, you know, which itself was contraband in the South. You couldn't directly send it through the mail. So it was the kind of thing that had to be sort of passed along. There were active resistance movements by Southern storekeepers to keep it out of the hands, of course, not just Black people, but white people, because it threatened their business. But it had so much more meaning to African Americans. And so there were bonfires in the street. There were rewards for burning the most catalogs. That's just how radical this catalog was. And, you know, it was something where Chicago could project its consumer culture into the world. It was like being at one of those big department stores downtown, only you were in the county in which you were born and you had never left. So it was a pretty amazing thing.
It is kind of crazy to think of how much of a disruptor it was that there were people who were burning Sears catalogs in the street.
Yeah.
But then also I wonder how even, and I read a little bit more of this as I was reading into your Twitter thread that you tweeted about this last week. Even so, I guess Sears worked really hard to even accommodate, because a customer is a customer, I guess, in Sears' eyes at the time, right? Whether or not they were mm-hmm. Black or white. So even if you couldn't read, could people, it didn't matter how literate you were, they could kind of still figure out how to fulfill your catalog order? Is that what was also happening then, too?
They really tried to make it open for everyone. You know, there were, obviously, it was a time of great immigration to the U.S. People didn't speak English, so you could order in Swedish or German or any other language. You could scribble out something, and hopefully the postman could help you place the order. You could even just ask the postman to buy a money order, because, of course, many of these post offices in very small, very rural, remote areas were also the general store. And so evading that was
wow. Talk
tricky.
About a monopoly, right?
Yeah, no, it was very hard. It was very hard, and so figuring out ways around it. Obviously, not always successful, but sometimes, and enough that in the catalog itself are printed instructions in how to evade your local post office by going to a postman directly. And it really speaks to how Sears Roebuck, you know, was trying to sell, but also the way in which they were able to help people who might otherwise not have such access.
And what do we know about Sears leadership at the time? Was this something that was altruistic, or were they just trying to sell more products?
Well, I mean, what's great to me is that, you know, it doesn't really matter. They were selling products and it did help people. And, you know, I think that the Sears leadership was actually pretty, you know, liberal for the time. And certainly Julius Rosenwald, who eventually becomes part of the leadership team there, along with Richard Sears. He's a Jewish suit maker from Chicago, and he eventually goes on to found, you know, many, many, many schools for African-American children around the South, the Rosenwald schools, donating millions of his own dollars. So he's obviously very racially liberal. And I think it's interesting to think about it both ways, both, you know, as how business can disrupt entrenched power, but also, you know, how it doesn't even matter as long as you are, you know, helping people get access and the radicalness of markets.
Louis, I want to return to that in a minute, but I just want to ask you a question. There was even a rumor at one point in time, just in terms of the resistance that was put up by particularly Southern, as you were saying, general store owners, and I imagine also just different Southern groups that were trying to enforce Jim Crow laws, different white supremacist groups. There was a rumor that Sears and Roebuck was actually a Black company, right?
Absolutely, that, you know, they couldn't show their face. This idea of you were shopping with people you'd never met, right? And they were not showing their face because they were Black, and that was something to be ashamed of, and that white people shouldn't shop with them. So they actually published pictures to, quote-unquote, prove that they were white.
Sears did,
yeah. And so did Alva Roebuck. And it's interesting in the way in which that story has persisted. You know, certainly what I found on Twitter was that for a lot of people who are of Black descent, you know, they had heard stories proudly that Roebuck was Black and that this was something to be proud of. And, you know, it certainly would have been, but I think also just it speaks to the ways in which race is so intertwined with this story and the story of power and liberation.
I'm speaking with economic historian Louis Hyman. He teaches at Cornell University. And Louis, so your tweet, this thread that you had, I think it was like something like 17,000 retweets.
It was
incredible engagement that people had with this online. I wonder what others, it's an interesting thing to me because first of all, my first thought was when I heard your name was an economic historian, I thought, what is that? But it's exactly this, isn't it? I mean, it's really understanding the role that the economy can intersect with history and culture, particularly when we're thinking about American society.
Yeah. So, I mean, part of it is just, you know, the history of business, the history of labor, the history of market conditions. But it's really about the way in which the economy intersects with other kinds of social and political considerations. So, you know, that Jim Crow was political, but also it was about everyday commercial transactions, about where you could and couldn't shop. And, you know, while we vote only every couple years, we shop every day. And it was that everydayness that made Jim Crow so frightening and so powerful. And, you know, I think it was interesting to see the connection it had to people on Twitter in thinking about, you know, contemporary conditions and the meaning, the legacy of Sears and the meaning of Amazon and all the other things. So hopefully history helps provide some context for thinking about the present day.
Right. And I wanted to ask you about the present day, because when we think about what it means for our shopping habits today, do you see contemporary examples of business disruptors? Or what about changing technology, specifically how you think that might continue to shift power?
Well, it was really interesting to see people's response on Twitter, to see, you know, so many people who are transgender talking about shopping on Amazon for clothes and to avoid uncomfortable situations or dangerous situations. A lot of African-American shoppers were talking about how they've been trailed through stores by sort of white employees, and, you know, digital e-commerce was a way around that. So I think, you know, obviously it's not the same as the Jim Crow South, but I do think that there's a way in which when we're watched as we shop, it's uncomfortable. And you can see things that are the 21st century equivalent of the Sears catalog as something continuing that legacy.
Yeah, it's a really interesting way to think about our economy and the power that we have as consumers on both sides of this, right?
Absolutely. And the sort of radical nature of market relationships, you know, to see how simply having more access can be so important to people. And one of the important themes of African-American history is the way in which African-Americans never have really had access to a truly free market system as owners, as workers, as consumers, and how those things all interconnect.
Mm. Really interesting history about Sears. One of, as we know in Illinois, one of our most iconic brands. It's just an interesting conversation that surfaced last week during the bankruptcy filing, and we wanted to bring that to you. Louis, thanks for being with us. Louis Hyman is an associate professor and the director of the Institute for Workplace Studies at the School of Industrial and Labor Relations at Cornell University. And his latest book actually is called Temp, How American Work, American Business, and the American Dream Became Temporary. Louis, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
A pleasure. Anytime. Thank you.
Sears was actually saved from liquidation earlier this month. That's when a judge allowed a deal to sell the company's remaining assets to its chairman, largest shareholder, and former CEO Eddie Lampert's hedge fund. Lampert's hedge fund took control of Sears on February 11th. His purchase of the company from bankruptcy means that its remaining 400 stores are still open. That's all the time we have for today and for this week. On Monday, I actually have jury duty, so Brian Moline will be filling in for me, and he'll be talking about sports betting. Now that the Supreme Court has allowed states to make their own rules on the issue, Illinois could be the next state to legalize this. Governor Pritzker has already said he wants to make this happen, but what are the costs and the benefits? We'll bring all that to you on Monday. By the way, earlier this week, we learned about a family who found help with housing through their school district. Our friends at the Illinois Newsroom have been looking into this and other housing stories throughout the state. We'll have that story, by the way, about homeless families and how they can be helped by the state at our website. But it also kicked off a series of questions we'd love to hear from you. We want to know what questions you have about housing. As our partners at the Illinois Newsroom are looking at housing, we are looking for questions we'd like you to give us. So we'll try to answer them. Are you having a hard time finding a place to rent or buy a house? Do you have questions about how to make it easier to afford a home, anything real estate or housing related? Please go to askthe21st.org to share your question with us. That's askthe21st.org. If you follow us on Twitter, our handle is 21stshow. We live tweet during the program with more analysis and background about what we're talking about. And when we're not on air, you can follow us for the latest in Illinois news. We've also a lot of helpful Twitter lists of Illinois politicians and political journalists. If you want to follow those, just check us out on Twitter. On our Facebook page, you can also search for The 21st to like us there. It's a good way to message us, comment on what we're working on, or post questions or comments you'd like us to ask on air. All those links, every other way to contact us. I mentioned Ask the 21st. If you want to find links to that, if you want to send us an email, leave us a voicemail. If you can't remember our social media handles, just remember our website, 21stshow.org. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for listening. Have a good day.